Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray, sponsored by CyberTrust.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business number 8, with thanks to our sponsor CyberTrust and hosting partner Vigabyte. I hinted last week that we'd have a very special guest on the show, and yes, it's come through. This week's guest is Richard A. Clarke. He was a special assistant to US President Bill Clinton throughout his tenure, advising him on issues around counterterrorism. He also did the same job for George W. Bush until his resignation in 2003. And from 2001 to 2003, he also served as the US government's cybersecurity czar. In other words, he's about as big time as it gets in the world of information security. I interviewed Mr. Clarke for a piece that ran in today's Sydney Morning Herald and Age newspapers. There's one or two spots in the recording where the audio gets a bit patchy. Sorry, that's my fault. You'll also hear me make reference to a few people without explaining who they are, so consider this a glossary of sorts. I make reference to the former Australian Defence Department CIO, Patrick Hannon. During the Clarke interview, I spoke about a conversation I had with Mr. Hannon some years ago, and I should point out that Mr. Hannon has since left his post at Defence. I also refer to Vint Cerf. He's the guy who co-wrote the TCP/IP protocol. These days, Cerf is a vice president at Google. He's regarded as the father of the internet by many. And finally, there's a reference to a gentleman named Mudge, who is a famed white hat hacker from Boston. He's also advised Richard Clarke on technical aspects of cybersecurity. The interview you're about to hear has a lot to do with Richard Clarke's most recent book, Breakpoint. It's a fictional thriller which deals with themes around technology and national security, and how new technologies like artificial intelligence, genetic engineering and robotics are changing the equation. The book starts with an attack on the fibre optic connections linking the US to the rest of the world. Mr. Clarke, I'd just like to start by asking you why you wrote Breakpoint.
Well, I write fiction because I think it's a way of telling people interesting facts, believe it or not, that they would never read, because most people don't read nonfiction. So if I wrote a book about the emerging technologies of the next 10 years and their social and political implications, no one would read it. Mm. But if I write a thriller set in the future where the issues are related to the new technologies, because it's a thriller, people will read it. They'll learn subliminally, perhaps, about the new technologies and about the issues.
Well, it certainly puts things on the agenda. But I'm wondering also if it's also a factor that you don't have to worry as much about saying something that you shouldn't, given that you have access to a lot of very protected material.
Well, the book still has to go through government security review. Any book I write ever for the rest of my life has to go through government security review, even if it's labeled as fiction. Mm. But you do, by writing fiction, don't have to worry as much about the fact checkers. Although in the end of the book, Breakpoint, I do go into some detail after the thriller part is over. I go into some detail about what the truth is in the book about the technologies, where they stand, and when they're expected to emerge on the scene.
Now, it turns out this book may have been a tad prophetic, because I understand that police in the United Kingdom have just foiled a plot, an Al-Qaeda plot, to blow up a major internet hub. Did you read about that?
Yeah, and there was also an arrest in the United States not long after 9/11 of an Al-Qaeda operative who was apparently supposed to do a second wave series of attacks, including on internet hubs. Mm. So we know Al-Qaeda does think about that. Now, to some extent, the book is prophetic in that it talked a lot about things like Chinese anti-satellite attacks. And I think the day the book was published in the United States, the Chinese did an anti-satellite attack.
Yeah, they shot one down, didn't they?
Yeah, which they also do with the book.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it's interesting, though, because the sort of scenario you describe, it looks like there's a pretty dire economic and military effect. So, you know, the warfighting capability is crippled. But surely this is something that is a more desirable effect to a nation state rather than terrorists. I mean, is that really where the bigger risk comes from?
I think the interesting thing about cyber attacks is that they can be done by either a nation state or by a terrorist group or by a criminal gang. And it really is one of these cases of the technology empowering small numbers of people to have very large effects.
Now, I When reading this, I couldn't help but think that, but have a small panic attack, because Australia, of course, is an island, and some of the, you know, the attacks that you describe would be, you know, extremely easily carried out on Australia. Would you say that we're more vulnerable to attack over here on our little island, even more so vulnerable attack than other countries?
In terms of cyber attack?
Yeah.
I think a physical attack on cyberspace, one that tries to cut off a country from the rest of cyberspace by hitting the physical connections, that's probably something that Australia is more vulnerable to than say, Europe or the United States. The United States has a lot of internet entry points into it, probably on the order of 20 major entry points, and that's a lot to take down. I think Australia's number is probably more on the order of 6.
Yeah, well, I remember a fishing trawler ran over a cable, I think it was in 2001, and basically dropped us off the internet for the day, which was an interesting and humbling experience.
Yeah.
How do you think we could better prepare? I mean, did the government in the United States during your tenure sort of take these issues seriously? Or what do you think could be done differently to ensure that we don't face the scenario that you outline in Breakpoint?
Well, there's no one thing, but in terms of the cyber attacks, what you do is you try to improve physical security around internet nodes. You try to create redundancy. In terms of the physical attack on cyberspace, in terms of the cyber attack on cyberspace, I think you want to make sure that there are backup systems, that certain functions that don't need to be connected to the internet, even indirectly, like electrical power, are disconnected. There's no real reason why I should be able to hack my way through from the internet into the control system of electric power.
Well, it is cheaper.
It is cheaper. There's no doubt about it. That's why these things are there. But there are some sensitive facilities which I think should be completely separated on private networks.
And you believe those to be power and things like that?
Power is certainly one of them. Conceivably, medical facilities are.
Mm. Also, in the book, you describe a bunch of criminals basically being able to engineer a cascading failure in the power grid. That sounded very similar to the power failure that happened in the northeast of the United States a few years ago, which also coincided with the timing of a computer worm. You're not trying to tell us anything there, are you?
Oh, I think the computer worm undoubtedly contributed to that power failure.
Mm.
The official Canadian-American study kind of dances around that issue. But it's pretty clear that because of the computer worm that was hitting a particular part of that power grid that day, that the reaction times of sensors were slower than they should have been.
Mm.
And that may have contributed to the system's failure.
Okay, look, I just want to switch topics a little bit here. In Breakpoint, you raise the concern repeatedly that equipment manufactured in foreign countries like China, technology equipment in particular, could contain Trojan horses, I guess, you know, backdoors, vulnerabilities, deliberately placed vulnerabilities. Is this a realistic concern, or were you taking a bit of a fictional license with that?
Well, it's a realistic concern to some people. When IBM stopped making laptops and sold the company to a Chinese manufacturer, the U.S. Defense Department and State Department immediately canceled all orders for the IBM laptops.
Yeah.
And, I think that reflects perhaps a paranoia, but it may also reflect something else.
You know, surely, the security community, the White Hat security community within the United States and other, you know, quote-unquote friendly countries would be able to detect such, you know, manipulation and insertion of backdoors into that type of technology, wouldn't they?
Oh, no. No, not if they were done properly. Very, very difficult to detect things that are embedded in chips, embedded in motherboards. I think it would be extraordinarily difficult, especially if they're not used until a certain point in time.
And then they just sort of turn on.
Yeah.
Knock, knock.
Remotely activated, and, it's hard to detect them when they're not being employed.
Now, I guess this is moving on a little bit more into the sort of espionage part of the book. But you describe, you know, attempts by states to get their hands on United States technology by infiltrating organizations in the private sector. Now, how much of a security challenge is it to administrations when civilian technology has actually become quite important to national security?
Well, it used to be that the government intelligence and defense agencies relied on what they called GOTS, government off-the-shelf products. There are very few, if any, of those left. Almost everything the government relies on, even in the military and in the intelligence community, is COTS, commercial off-the-shelf, which is just a way of saying that what the Pentagon is running and what the CIA is running is the same thing that you're running on your home computer. And therefore, it is of concern when foreign nationals are employed in American companies. It's also a concern if Americans employed in American companies are convinced to spy, whether that's industrial espionage or foreign espionage. There's some reason to believe it's going on.
But I'd imagine also that the CIA and NSA would have an interest of having its own plants in, you know, certainly software organizations, so that it can plant weaknesses and vulnerabilities that only they know about, and they can exploit them in, you know, when that technology is deployed overseas.
Well, I think American manufacturers depend so much now on the world market that they would be reluctant to do that, because if they ever get caught, they'd lose huge portions of their market. So I don't think they'd do it.
I'm not suggesting the software companies are doing it willingly, but perhaps that there are some clandestine efforts underway on behalf of the United States government to get it done anyway.
Well, that's possible. It probably gives the United States government more credit for competence than it deserves.
So you don't really think that they're doing a great job of this stuff, do you? I mean, certainly the book reads like a warning that they need to snap out of it.
Yeah, I think it's meant to be a warning, not only on the computer side, but also on the genetic side, and robotics and artificial intelligence. What I'm trying to say is that there's not just one technology that's emerging in the next 10 years. There are five or six major technologies that are going to be mutually supportive, and all burst on the scene in a big changed way in the next 10 years. And they will drastically change the nature of society. That will have political, economic, social, national security implications, and we haven't thought them through.
Well, I guess it does come down to the point of, you know, defining what is human. I had a chat with Vint Cerf probably about a month ago about this very issue. He was in Australia launching Cochlear, a center which promotes cochlear implants, and we had a bit of a chat about the transhumanism thing, primarily because I'd been reading your book at the time. But I mean,
so had he, by the way.
Okay, yeah. That's interesting, because he'd basically said that you know, he didn't go in for the Kurzweil stuff, you know, where machines are interacting with us at a cognitive level, but the bionic stuff is okay. So it seems that everyone's got their own sort of set of ethics around what should and shouldn't be done. Have you noticed that as well? Is that?
Yeah, there's very much a variety of ethics. One conservative stand in the United States is, we'll use genetic engineering to fix mistakes, but we won't use it to do enhancements.
Mm.
Well, that may be a nice little paper distinction that one can make, but it won't hold up in the real world, because if you can do genetic engineering to fix mistakes, then the additional capability needed to do enhancements is minimal.
Mm.
If you can do the one, you can do the other. And if we have an industry doing genetic engineering to fix mistakes, it's not going to be able to resist enhancements.
No, it's doubtful, isn't it? And it does seem, I mean, you're suggesting that this is actually quite close. We've always viewed this as something that's been 20, 30 years out, but you say it's happening now.
I think the key thing to understand, and it's difficult to understand, is that the rate of change is accelerating constantly. And therefore, things that used to take 20 years are taking 5. 10. You know, we've already seen reports of major progress in all of these fields. Virtually on a daily basis, we get reports of major progress. also, you know, over the weekend, we heard that stem cells have been used to grow heart parts, heart valves. We know that the stem cells have been used to grow an entire human bladder. People expected that was a long way off, and it's already happened. So
yeah.
Whether, and people quibble with Breakpoint. They say, oh, this is not stuff that's 5 years out, it's 10 years out. Well, I'm not sure it makes any difference. We
it's
don't
happening.
Know.
Yeah.
But it's going to happen, and it's going to happen in the lifetime of most of us.
Mm.
And it's going to, the combination and interaction of progress in artificial intelligence, robotics, genetic engineering, pharmacology, computer science, human-machine implants, all of those things coming at the same time and reinforcing each other. When we're done with the initial deployment of all of that, we're going to turn around and say we're living in a different society than we were 5 or 10 years earlier.
Mm. I guess I'm wondering, too, do you foresee the day when a technological assault, the crippling of a country's data networks or a similar attack, will actually be the best way of achieving a military objective instead of just a secondary attack that's supposed to complement a more conventional campaign like dropping bombs?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because, for one thing, it may be difficult to know who did it. So you have some anonymity, which is difficult with conventional attacks. And if you do it properly, a nation might be deterred militarily.
Mm. Deterred or crippled?
Well, both.
Yeah.
Particularly when you think about what the Pentagon says it's doing, the Pentagon says, oh, good news, we're having a revolution in military affairs, and we are going to net-centric warfare, where everything will be netted together. And they tout this as progress. You know, there's a scene in the book where a unit of American troops wearing these new sort of robot uniforms are all frozen stiff and can't move. That's a metaphor for what could happen to the entire United States military if it's net-centric.
The chief information officer of our Defense Department was Patrick Hannon, who, yeah, got very excited describing battleships as nodes in a network that were just essentially weapons delivery systems. And I, you know, of course, coming from a security background, even then was thinking, yes, well, I imagine gentlemen like Mudge would have quite a lot of fun with those little toy boats.
Well, there was a U.S. destroyer that was, this was several years ago, was out on an initial shakedown cruise, and the Microsoft software that it was running in its control system went kaflooey, and the entire ship stopped dead in the water, and they had to send tugs out to pull it back.
It was running Windows?
Yeah, Windows.
Okay, that's a surprise, I got to say. I would have thought that it would be custom software, but...
Yeah, but there's no custom software anymore.
Yeah.
At the operating system level.
Look, I had one more question on my list, which is, you know, is it fair to assume that U.S. agencies also have a cyber attack capability? And by that I mean for the purposes of both intelligence gathering, like hacking into Iranian government servers to find, you know, plans to build nuclear power plants, or, you know, even disrupting a foreign state's connection to the Internet.
I think both the United States and China have acknowledged having offensive cyber attack units.
Well-developed capabilities.
Well, that they exist and they have them.
Okay. Is there anything else that I haven't asked that you feel I should have?
No. I think that's pretty well covered. It. The point of the novel is to say there's the IT revolution was a major revolution, but there's another one that will come in the next 5 to 10 years, and it will be even more revolutionary than the IT. Experience was.
Mr. Clark, thank you very much for taking time out to speak to me.
Great to talk to you.
That was former White House counterterrorism official and cybersecurity czar, Richard Clark. And that's all we have time for in this special edition of Risky Business. You can visit our website at itradio.com.au to leave a comment or email me at patrick@dotbob.net, and I'll spell that out. It's patrick@dotbob.net. Don't forget to check out our new show, A Series of Tubes with Ian Yates, which goes live every Wednesday. It's a networking and systems integration show. Now, thanks to our sponsor CyberTrust and hosting provider Vigabyte, and we'll see you all next week. Cheers. Thanks for listening.